We're going to pick up our study in Judges chapter 6, verse 1 in just a moment. You have seen the cycle of the judges several times now, where the people of Israel as a whole get involved in sin. So God, in judgment, causes them to come under the subjugation of some foreign power, which causes the Israelis to be sorry. Maybe that they got caught most of the time, but eventually, that sorrow leads them to cry out in supplication to the Lord, asking Him to save them, to send them a new judge, which He does, and so they come under God's salvation. And as long as that judge remains strong and alive, the Israelis tend to behave themselves. But once they die, the cycle starts all over again. Well, Judges chapter number 6 picks up the story at the end of the 40 years of peace under the judgeship of Barak and under the prophetic leadership of Deborah. Deborah probably died first, that would be my guess. But Barak eventually dies, even though it's not mentioned here. And the sin that is just below the surface within Israel breaks free once again. Chapter 6 of the book of Judges. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, and He Who Is gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian overpowered Israel, and because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that are in the mountains, and the caves, and the strongholds. For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites, and the Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Now, the Midianites are down to the south of the Dead Sea region, off to the southeast of there. The Amalekites, they're in a variety of different places, but they do have interaction with the Midianites. The peoples of the east are probably a reference to Moab and Edom, which is in that same general vicinity, and maybe the Ammonites as well. So these people sweep into Israel, which is a very productive region of the Middle East, just as the crops are being harvested. They let the Israelis do all the hard work of planting and irrigating and pruning and harvesting. They let them do all that hard work, and then they sweep in and grab a great big portion of the harvest. The Israelis are trying to respond by hiding out. Part of the harvest might actually be people taken into slavery. So they try to hide out and hide their stuff as best they can. Verse number 4 continues. They would encamp against them and devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza, and leave no substance in Israel, and no sheep or ox or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be counted, so that they laid waste the land as they came in. So a locust plague just sweeps in and just wipes everything green out. This Midianite horde and all their associated allies, they're very much like that. They wait until the harvest time, so we're talking about the summer, and they come in and they just take everything, or they take a large portion of it, and then they're gone again until next year. So Israel, verse 6, was brought very low because of Midian. And the people of Israel cried out for help to He Who Is. Now, this Midianite oppression lasts for about 7 years, we're told. By my calculation, that makes it about 1188 to 1182 BC. So Israel's been in the land for a good long time. But they have suffered an awful lot because of their sin, because of this cycle that God warned them about through Moses. I'll bless you if you're living by the covenant, but I will curse you if you're not living by the covenant. And so they spent a lot of time under the curse of God. Verse 7, when the people of Israel cried out to He Who Is on account of the Midianites, He Who Is sent a prophet to the people of Israel. And he said to them, Thus says He Who Is the God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am He Who Is your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. So God says through this prophet, I told you not to go down this route. I told you not to go and worship the other gods and goddesses of the Canaanites, but you did it anyway. That is why you're suffering. Verse 11. Now the angel of He Who Is came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belongs to Joash, the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Now, this Ophrah is to the north of the areas that we've been talking about a lot in the taking of the Promised Land. Bethel, Ai, is the area that they came up into after Jericho. And Ophrah is just a few miles north and a little bit east of the Bethel Ai region. So it's in the heart of the land of Israel that they've been living in during the time that they've been inside the Promised Land. Now, this young man, Gideon, he is trying to keep his harvest of wheat secret. So he's down inside of a wine press, he's separating the kernels of wheat from the chaff that is part of the surrounding around the head of grain. Now, wine presses were below ground level, because what you would do is you would have a container that you'd put the grapes in, and you'd press them either by using your feet or you would use some sort of mechanical means, and the wine, the juice, would flow out into this wine press bin this pit. And that's from which you would get it out and put it in containers. So he's down inside that below ground level area, and he's throwing his wheat up in the air and letting the wind blow the chaff off to one side, and then it drops back down into the pit again. And so that's keeping him from being seen from a distance as harvesting or processing his grain. So he's hoping by this that he won't gain the attention of any spies of the Midianite hordes. Verse 12, the angel of He Who Is appeared to him and said to him, He Who is with you, O mighty man of valor. And Gideon said to him, Please, sir, if He Who is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Where are all these wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted us, saying, Did not He Who Is bring us up out of Egypt? but now he who is has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian. So Gideon is not happy with the situation, and he's kind of blaming God for being absent from the situation, which is typical. We see this happening even amongst modern believers. When things are happening bad, they want to know why God's not fixing it, why God's not jumping in and taking care of the situation right now. Well, the answer might actually be the answer that we find right here, and that is because Israel is in sin. That's why God has not been stepping in. God was waiting until Israel repented and had learned their lesson, their most recent lesson, of what happens when you disobey. So, verse 14, he who is, turn to him. Now, this is interesting because the way that it's phrased here, it seems as if it is God himself that has taken on this form and is conversing with Gideon. Now, we do know that it started out by talking about the angel of the Lord. The Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, written about 300 years before Jesus, has angel of the Lord even in this passage right here in verse 14. But some people have suggested that God is so invested in Gideon that he himself took on the form of a human messenger, an angel in this case, to come and talk with him. I think it doesn't make any difference in the long run, because even when angels are the ones that are present and talking, they use the first person, because angels are God's messengers. I've used the illustration many times that if the phone rang and somebody answered it, and then they suddenly held the phone out to you and said, "Here, it's your mom, talk to her," you wouldn't automatically assume that they thought that the phone was your mom. You would see the phone as an instrument being used by your mom to speak to you. And you would even talk to that instrument in the first person, and that instrument would talk to you in the first person. So that's kind of the way that angels work. They're like God's phone sets, instruments. So the angel of he who is turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do not I send you?" So God tells Gideon at this point, you're the guy. You're going to be the answer to the very prayer that you were just referencing. Where is God? Why isn't he helping us miraculously? Well, you're the one that's going to be used as the miracle. Now, Gideon is not so quick to jump on board with this. He's kind of like Moses at his calling. He said to him, "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my father's house." So he's like, "God, you've got to be kidding me. My family is hardly even known in the tribe of Manasseh, and I'm just the kid of the family. How am I going to be of any help?" Verse 16, "And he who is said to him, 'But I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man.' And he said to him, 'If now I've found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speaks with me. Please, do not depart from me here until I come to you and bring out my present and set it before you.' And he said, 'I'll stay till you return.'" So Gideon is now going to ask God to give him a sign to verify for him that it really is God that's asking him to do this, which at this point, that's very reasonable, because as far as Gideon can tell, this is just a human person that's talking to him. The angel of the Lord is appearing like a human messenger. So Gideon went into his house, and he prepared a young goat and unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket and the broth he put in a pot, and he brought them to him under the terebinth and presented them. So he treats him as a special guest, and he goes in and very quickly prepares a fast midday meal. Now, fast by their standards. It would have taken about an hour or so to get this thing taken care of, but he would have been back out in the heat of the day. Everybody kind of takes a couple of hours off to rest and in the shade and eat some meal. So he brings this food back out to him. The angel of God said to him, "Take that meat and the unleavened cakes and put them on this rock, and then pour the broth over them." Now, you can kind of picture Gideon going, "Wow, that's kind of a strange thing for me to do with food I brought out for you to eat." But he did so. Then the angel of He Who Is reached out the tip of the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened cakes, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and then the angel of He Who Is vanished from his sight. So the angel treats this as an offering and brings God's supernatural fire to consume it. And then he disappears, just like that. That's a pretty good sign that this was the angel of God. Gideon perceived that he was the angel of He Who Is, and Gideon said, "Alas, oh, my master, He Who Is, for now I've seen the angel of He Who Is face to face." So he's afraid that he's a dead man because he didn't properly respond in his mind to what he was being told. But, verse 23, He Who Is said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." Now, whether that was an audible voice that came out of the air, or whether it was a voice that popped up in his head, or maybe, if the story is a little bit more drawn out than what it looks like here, maybe he laid down and slept, and God appeared to him in a dream and said, "You need to just calm down and be at peace. I am not going to kill you. I'm going to use you." But Gideon responds appropriately. Verse 24, Gideon built an altar to He Who Is and called it He Who Is Peace. And to this day, it stands at Ophrah, which belongs to the Abiezrites. Now, let's deal with this issue that I've talked about before. The only authorized place to make sacrifices is supposed to be the tabernacle altar at Shiloh, which is several miles to the north and a little bit west of where Gideon is at right this moment. But it becomes clear that during this period of time, that the centrality of worship of God at Shiloh has fallen off. That even the leadership is being bad about providing that centralized location for sacrifices. Remember that God was having to use Deborah in the generation before this to provide information to the Israeli people prophetically, because apparently the high priest wasn't functioning properly, and neither were the Levites. So evidently, people have started, if they have a serious connection to God, offering sacrifices where they're at. And God is apparently putting up with that. And here's an example. Gideon, because of this special event, builds a worship altar right there and sacrifices to God on it, and God accepts that. Verse 25, "That night, He Who Is said to him," apparently in a dream, "take your father's bull, the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to he who is your God at the top of the stronghold here with stones laid in due order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you shall cut down. Now this is where we find out that Gideon's family has deteriorated in such a fashion that during this time period of the 7 years of Midianite oppression, they're worshiping Baal and Asherah. Remember, Baal is the thunder and lightning god of the Canaanites. He's the top dog. And Asherah is kind of his sister, wife, companion. She's the queen of heaven. She's the goddess of grain. And she's like the number two god in this little companionship. And Baal is typically worshipped by having a stone that's raised up. And Asherah is typically worshipped by having some sort of tree, either alive or carved out, like a totem sort of thing, that is near the altar where you offer sacrifices to her. So in this dream, Gideon is told, you need to chop down the Asherah pole and take that wood, put it on a brand new altar to he who is, an altar made of stones uncut by human hands, and then take your dad's number two bull, butcher it, sacrifice it, and burn it up in my honor. Verse 27. So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as he who is had told him, but because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night. So he recruits 10 of his servants, sworn to do whatever it is he wants them to do. And at night, the next night, they sneak around and do what God told them to do, because he's afraid of his dad. He's afraid of his family members. And he's afraid of the town as well. Apparently, his dad is the one that maintains this altar for the city of their community, Ophrah. All right, let's find out what happens next. Verse 28. When the men of the town rose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, the Asherah beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. And they said to one another, who has done this thing? And after they searched and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. And then the men of the town said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, for he has broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah beside it. So they want this blasphemer, because that's the way they're thinking about it, this desecrator of sacred objects, to be executed. And they tell his dad, that's what we want. That's what we need to do to bring honor back to the situation. But Joash said to all who stood against him, will you contend for Baal? Will you save him? Well, whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he's a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down. So Gideon's dad loves Gideon, and he does not want his son to be executed, even though dad apparently was all on board with this worship of Baal and Asherah. It was on his property. But he starts standing up for his son, and he says something of philosophical interest. If Baal really is a god, then shouldn't he be able to stand up for himself and do something about having his altar taken down? Let him contend for himself. Now, in Hebrew, That gives rise to Gideon's nickname. Verse 32. Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Yarub Baal. That is to say, let Baal contend for himself because he broke down his altar. Yarub means let him contend. And then Baal is the name of this god. So let Baal contend for himself. And that becomes his nickname from here on out. Now, all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east came together, and they crossed the Jordan and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. So they sweep up from the south through the annexed eastern territories, and they start grabbing all the grain and products that are over there. And once they've got all that, they sweep across the Jordan River, just south of the Sea of Galilee, and that takes them into the valley of Jezreel, which is north of the hill country that Gideon lives in. Verse 34, but the spirit of he who is clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Abiezrites were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they too were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet him. So Gideon is now being empowered by the power of the Holy Spirit to act as the new judge. And remember, new judges always start their tenure by getting rid of the last enemy, the last subjugator. So he puts out the militia call to his own area, Manasseh, and to the areas to the north of the area of Jezreel. Everybody, let's get together. We need to fight for God's word and God's command. And that's where we'll have to take up the story the next time we get into God's word.